today I'm with Mike Lester and Martin Brunt, having a cup of tea early in the morning. Met through various work conferences over the years where I've been with my husband.
Yep.
So I'm going to go on to the first question, which is, do you drink tea?
Yes.
All the time. Apart from this cup of coffee that I've got in my hand.
How much tea do you normally drink?
Probably 3 or 4 cups a day.
Yeah, same.
Especially with clients. With coffee.
Yeah, clients mostly.
Mm. And what's your favourite cup of tea?
Probably the breakfast cup, the first cup in the morning. When you drink the tea in bed.
Oh, great.
Before getting up.
Oh, great. And if I'm feeling particularly exotic, then I'll have lemon and no milk in my Earl Grey.
I think the Queen drinks Earl Grey with milk. I've definitely heard that somewhere, so I don't.
Yeah, yeah.
I no longer feel bad about having milk in my Earl Grey.
No, no, I understand.
No, I'm Earl Grey with milk.
Earl Grey with milk.
Yep, most of the time. I like weak tea, so it's just easy.
How do you respond to the statement, Christianity in the UK is not dying, but sleeping?
Well, I would probably agree with it. I think it's not. It's not adapted to modern life. And I think that it's still, it's stayed with its traditional roots, and that is becoming less and less accessible to a lot of people.
Martin's very quiet.
I think it's a good. I think it's a good question. I don't think it exists necessarily in the way that people would have, might say a few centuries ago, where it was the centre of everything. So I think I think religion is there for you when you need it most. So unfortunately, we have a sort of a structural, pyramidical system around churches and cathedrals, which is understandable, because it reflects the history and the past. But in the modern context of wars and deaths and all those sort of divorces and all the things that can go on in a person's life, I think religion is still as important today as it ever was. Now, whether or not you need a network of churches in order for that to be available or not, I don't know.
It's quite... One of the reasons why I wanted to kind of talk to people about this question was it's really contradictory from the evidence where we are, because almost nothing I can do will get people to come to church on a Sunday, but our weekday things are now, we get more people through our weekday activities, services, things that we do,
yep,
or our Sunday afternoon than we do our main Sunday morning. So yeah, we've kind of, our flagship is no longer our flagship. And that's quite a cultural change for us. So we've got children's things and family things and older people's things, but it's become, in a way, a series of niche markets rather than
is
one
that
big.
Because the Sunday service of the morning is the traditional service, and it's probably the one that's least changed. And the other services you make reference to are probably more easily adaptable to people's lifestyles?
Partly. Although not all our Sunday mornings are very traditional, but we just have a problem with Sunday mornings, I think. So some of the weekday services we have are very traditional services. So two of them are using Book of Common Prayer, which is language from the 17th century. But it's not the language that people are coming for. People are coming for the peace, the quiet, the reflection. The quietness of those services seems to appeal to people who need a little oasis, who are around in the week.
So those people that come to those midweek services, do they not attend the weekend services? So do you have different audiences?
Mm-hmm.
So is it the fact you're never going to get the numbers that the church used to have, because rather than being one main service per week or two or three on a Sunday, those services are now spread out throughout the week, and so people can dip in and out of those services as suits their lifestyle?
That's quite a difficult question, because they've started after we've... Those people already stopped or didn't come to the Sunday mornings. So they're not people who've left the Sunday morning service to go to the other service. They're people who have been recruited to those midweek services mainly.
And do you know how that happens then? What has attracted them to that? Is it friends? Is it something that the church is doing themselves?
It's, I guess there's the whole thing about a culture of invitation.
Yeah, that's, I think that's a great phrase. I think it depends. I think how you see religion in your life, really. So is it a club that you turn up to regularly on a weekday or a weekend day, or is it something that's quietly in the background of living your life in a Christian way?
So one of the things that we do is Friday afternoon church in one of our villages, which is a very child-friendly service. Mm-hmm. And we quite often have 30 children and 20 adults at that, and that's the biggest single service that we have in the month. And people love coming to that. Some of the older people who are there ostensibly to help, but they're part of the service, choose to come to that service rather than other services in the month. So,
but isn't that an indication of where church and religion... Christianity plays a role then in young people's lives, because of baptism and confirmation and those types of things that are part of an early journey in Christianity? That's where that starts from. As we get older and time aware, that you stop going perhaps. And
I guess for some there are less baptisms than there used to be. Less people are kind of thinking about that, unless they're already part of the church family, really, and we have some, but those sorts of things are really important for providing places where people feel they kind of understand what's going on in the culture. So it's very much non-traditional. It has much more of a culture of maybe a baby and toddler group in some ways, which people understand culturally, and then we can understand them, but we have worship and prayer as part of it, that. And that is that works well for them.
But that's where the growth is going to come for the church, isn't it? If you can get children at a young age and say, give me the child and I'll give you the man. So if you can get children at a young age to enjoy a church service and understand the message of Christianity, then they're less likely to move away in later life.
But it's also toddler groups, isn't it? So the church, I think, is well placed to do that infrastructure-wise, so church halls and as you say, mothering groups coming together, that type of thing. The church has historically played a very good role. I remember my boys both going along to early toddler groups at the church and being part of that process. Both were baptised, but both haven't been confirmed. So it's an indication that confirmation in sort of early teens, late teens, probably doesn't happen, perhaps because the link between the family commitment to regularly attend gets a little bit lost along the way.
So did your boys start going to sporting things on Sunday mornings? So that's one of the Sunday morning issues for us. Is that actually when they start going to football or rugby or swimming or hockey or whatever, if you don't have something else, then they're not going to be able to continue their journey.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's quite a challenge.
And football for boys can start as little as 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, you know. So if you're a toddler and you're into sort of, you know, what I will call church hall activities and preschool type sort of stuff, then of course as soon as football and your friends and that wider community aspect starts to kick in, church potentially becomes lesser. So I think church as a structure somewhat reflects the history of Norman buildings that have been constructed a few hundred years ago that don't necessarily always fit the common modern outlook. It's not true of all churches, but somewhat reflective of the past.
We struggle with our Norman buildings, because we don't have any church halls. So we have to, that's our space, unless we make a conscious decision to move it out of the church building and to hire in a hall. But we, one of them, we've recently set up a toddler group, and we are managing to manage a space. Yeah.
But you wouldn't create an organisation based on the infrastructure that you've got now, would you?
No.
I mean, if you actually wanted, if it was a business, sorry to blaspheme in that way, but if you would create a business and you were all say, look, we're all going to operate out of a museum that's massively underfunded, and all the buildings are going to fall down at some point in the future, and they're drafty and cold, and you know, sometimes inaccessible, you just wouldn't, that wouldn't be the first set of principles that you would set the structure upon.
But if the church was to take a lesson from business, they would probably close the churches down and build buildings, sell the churches and build buildings that were more appropriate and more conveniently situated.
I'm really interested in that. Who do you think is going to buy one of my Grade 1 star-listed church buildings?
I think lots of people would if they could make that into a home. If they could convert that to living accommodation, you see that with old railway stations, you see it against, there's a church local to us, it's an art gallery.
I'm not sure that there would be a market for any of my buildings because of the permissions that would be denied.
Of course, yeah, no, absolutely. That's more the issue. It's more the what we...
But then what comes first then? If you can't get the permissions and you continue as you are, it's something that is gradually eroding away, so eventually it'll erode to nothing. And you'll have a building you can't use for anything else, and you won't have a congregation.
That is the nub of the issue.
So you'd have to say then, do I have to mothball that? And make it a museum and make it something completely different, but I need still, if I'm going to grow the church, if I'm going to make the church relevant and vibrant, it's got to look at something else. And if that means we've got to run two things parallel until the government or the National Lottery or Heritage England or the National Trust say, actually, these are some buildings that we ought to be protecting. But it's
more than that. It's not just buildings. The church isn't just about buildings, is it? It's also about how it structures itself in terms of the people that are within it and its own structures. So, I mean, the government struggles with the NHS. It's got no chance of sorting out religion. Politically, it's going to stay away from
the government's not going to sort out religion, is it?
No, it's not.
Ask them to do that.
No,
the church needs to sort the church out.
Because of the establishment of the Church of England, changes, big structural changes to the Church of England need to go through Parliament.
Yeah.
So it's.
But
it's,
I don't know if opening a new church or operating a new building would have to go through Parliament.
No, but parish boundary changes do.
But you wouldn't have to change the boundary, would you? You just put it within the parish into a more convenient place.
What's the best thing about working in financial services?
I think the freedom and independence that it gives you. Because you're working for yourself, you're your own boss. You can make your own decisions. You can make your own judgments. And you can work in those areas that you want to work in.
Helping people. Often I would say to people that it's your life choices that drive your finances, not your finances that drive your life choices. So if you're getting married or if you're moving house or you've lost your job or you've got promoted or you're retiring or you're having children or whatever it is, or each one of those events has an impact on your financial set of circumstances, really. So at that point, people potentially need financial advice and need help, need somebody that they can trust, somebody that they can turn to, that will give them some pointers as to what they might want to consider. So that puts us in a very, very unique situation. The thing that always strikes me is you can meet somebody for the first time and just by asking a few questions as you're doing, they'll tell you absolutely everything. Never met you before, but they'll tell you how much is in their bank account, what their hopes and dreams are, what their fears are, what their concerns are. If you ask the right questions and listen and deal with them in the right way, they'll confide in you absolutely everything. So that, I think, places us in a very, very unique world. And the government, through the FCA, actually wants us to do that. It's called Know Your Client. Very, very few organisations do you have to demonstrate that amount of knowledge of anybody that you deal with. If you, mean, if any other form of retail, you don't have to fill in a questionnaire and ask, you know, the sort of questions that we have to ask. So helping people.
So the next question is, I don't know whether this is more for one person than the other, but do you think football is a religion?
No, it's a passion, which is not a religion.
I don't know, do you agree, Martin?
Well, in the strict definition of religion, obviously not. But I think if you look at the conversation that we were starting to have around attracting people to come to a common place, to cheer and participate passionately, to be vocal, animated, then I would say many football stadiums around the world are somewhat reflective of the sort of engagement that you might want within, say, a church or a congregation. The fact that you can get 50, 60, 70, 80,000 people into a structure cheering for red or blue or yellow or whatever the colours are. So from that side of things, and then from the ability to argue against the indefensible because the referee's made a poor decision, then there's a lot of, you know, argument around football in the same way there's a lot of argument around religion in the past.
But the allusion to football being a religion is to do with a large number of people gathering in one place. This is what the church did over the centuries. And in the absence of the church doing that...
But if you're talking about Jesus Christ and his sacrifice and resurrection and all the rest of it that comes from that, then obviously not. And to make that comparison, it would be somewhat disrespectful in many ways, but...
I guess... If you do archaeology and you're talking about religion, you think about things like the cultic artefacts that people have, so the clothing, the things that people own, the things that people have in their houses, which represent the kind of things that give them meaning. So I wonder if in that sort of anthropological description of religion, whether football might fit that more.
Well, it's tribal, isn't it? So if you look at the various religious groups, Jewish, Catholic, Christianity, Muslim, they're somewhat reflective of, you know, that tribal aspect of it. It's an oversimplification, but...
But in the football, there is no leaders, are there? So there's not a distinction. If there is artefacts, if there is a uniform, it's a common uniform. It's a scarf, it's a football shirt, it's the same colour, it's the same price. So whether if you're a bishop, an archbishop, if you're... Or then your uniform is completely different to that of the congregation, so there's a barrier, and that's not there in sport.
But there is ideology, though, isn't there?
There is absolutely ideology, but it's not a religious ideology, is it?
No, but an ideology of a person is somewhat similar to the ideology of the disciples of Christ or what have you, in the sense that it was focused on a person.
Because if you think of Christ when he was alive, he looked no different to the disciples. He didn't wear anything differently. If you didn't recognise who Christ was, you'd look at the disciples, they're all the same.
I think the point you make is fair, but I don't think if he was... if you look at sort of the Jewish faith, that they would necessarily have seen themselves dressed in the same sort of garb, wouldn't they? The high priests of the time would have been in very rich robes and would have seen themselves as members of state and members of... Yeah. Whereas the disciples and Christ would have been probably not much more than...
But society's moved against that now, hasn't it? That's the problem. Society's moved on. They don't want that hierarchy.
I don't know that. I don't know.
What's interesting for me is that in some of our services, I don't wear a robe, and in others of the services, I wear a very simple robe, really. In the services where I don't wear a robe, 20% of the people in the service come up and comment on what I was wearing. So for me, there's something about anonymity, of actually what's really important, and it's not to do with what I'm wearing. So I kind of feel that if I'm not going to wear a robe, I need some other sort of really nondescript uniform, which is actually very not something for comment.
We could wear a cross, couldn't you? A simple cross. Not a small cross, but not over large, but something that's more noticeable.
But people come and say, oh, where did you get that dress from?
Yeah.
Which I find is that wasn't what you were supposed to be thinking about during the survey.
I think if you look at the evangelicals in America, one of their successes is you can't tell the difference between the preacher and the congregation. from their appearance.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting.
But religion can be multifaceted, can't it? As it, because it's a form of leadership as well, and also it's a protector of the faith, as however you see your denomination and however you see your faith. So it can, you can be one of the people, absolutely, and you should be reflective of the people. But at certain times, religion is there also to give guidance and support and direction.
Can do all of that though without a uniform?
No, it can. But sometimes it helps. I mean, if you think of, you know, any structure of organisation, it helps to be able to identify who your leaders are.
Well, that's a good point. You look at all the great businesses. Look at Steve Jobs. Look at Richard Branson. You, Bill Gates. You can't tell them from Adam that Mark's, whatever the Facebook guy is, they're just wearing, they're wearing chinos, they're wearing denims, they're wearing open neck polo shirts, that they're not ordaining themselves with lots of things that says, I am a wealthy, powerful person. You can tell that by looking at me. They're very much like the rest of the people that work for them.
But you could say that, but if you take the opposite, you could say, take the military, and you could go, well, that's absolutely true. You wouldn't want somebody to stand out, because if they stood out, they'd get harmed. So, but it comes down to the point that you've made, and that is identification can still happen in very subtle ways. It doesn't matter that somebody's wearing jeans or t-shirts. It doesn't matter whether or not they're identifiable or not. But it speaks to leadership, it speaks to direction, it speaks to, because the whole point of a business, if you use a business as an example, is you set a business plan as a set of goals, and you share that vision with the people around you to give them some sense of where they're going. And so therefore, when you look to religion in a particular way, and they're, if they're the protector of the faith and they want to help their congregation make that journey in whatever shape or form, physical or metaphysical, then you're looking for people that have read the Bible and understand and study it. So when you're talking to a priest, they are at their fundamental the same as us, but they have taken the time to study the text of the Bible to the point that they can interpret it and give meaning to situations as they arise in our lives.
Yeah. But you don't need a special uniform for that?
No, but I wouldn't get hung up on the uniform. I'd just get hung up on the sense that you want people that you can trust. At its core, in the end, you are looking for people that are like you, that you can trust.
Would you take that as far as not having a dog collar?
Yeah, I probably would.
That's quite interesting, because I find that people, the trust relationship builds very quickly when I'm wearing a dog collar. But what I try to wear with it when I'm at work, it are clothes that make me look like a GP. That sort of level of dress. So smart, don't always wear a jacket, sometimes wear a jacket. But that sort of level in the community of someone who would be a trusted member, that sort of image is the one which I've quite consciously tried to adopt.
I think in the modern sense of it, that sort of staid, rigid view of a priest or a vicar or an archbishop or what have you has probably changed, because the modern way of life, where we're more relaxed in ourselves, we don't sort of doff our cap to the Lord or landed gentry anymore. So I think it's about being all things to all people. And I think if you're going to sit in a congregation of young, energetic people, then the dog collar probably doesn't apply. But if you're going to speak to a grieving widow, it probably does. So it's horses for courses in that sense, because it still represents a statement. It still carries merit because of what it symbolises.
What's your favourite thing beginning with T?
Time. With the family, with people you care about.
Well, my first response to that one you asked me yesterday was Toblerone.
It's true.
And just because I like being different and not saying the obvious, I'm going to stick with Toblerone.
Okay. No, that's great. I'd just like to say thank you very much for having a cup of tea with me today. It's quite a noisy setting, so we'll see how the edit goes. But thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you, a pleasure.